Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Wildermuth, political reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Today we delve into the topic of religion, the roles it plays in our society and the roles it could play, the areas where religion and society collide and conflict, and how we can smooth out some of those conflicts. The U.S. is as diverse in religious belief as it is in population. As we are all aware, religion and secular society often wage battles over the role religion should have in everyday public life, including schools, government entities, and even communication. Today, we will attempt to find ways to have these diverging ideas coexist and even augment each other. Our panelists today are Michael Lerner, rabbi and editor at Tikkun, Michael Maudlin, editorial director at Harper San Francisco, Stephen Prothero, chair of religion department at Boston University. And we're going to start with a question, and the basic question that everybody here wants answered is, what role does religion play in American society, or should it play in American society? And we're going to start with Rabbi Lerner.
There's a deep spiritual crisis in American society. People are living in a society in which the bottom line of most of our institutions is to maximize money and power. Institutions are judged efficient, rational, and productive to the extent that they maximize money and power. But most human beings have a different set of desires. They want a way of connecting to higher meaning and purpose for their lives. They want a society, and they want human relationships which are based on love and caring and generosity. The only institution that officially is committed to that alternative way are those institutions that fit in under the general guise of either religion or spirituality. They implicitly, and I believe explicitly, need to develop a counter vision, a vision of a new bottom line of love and caring and generosity to counter the dominant line. But until that happens, people are desperate for some form of life, some place in which those hungers, which are just as important to them as fulfilling their material needs, are satisfied. And so people respond to existing religious communities and try to find within them a framework for satisfying their hunger for love and connection, for community, and for a transcendent meaning and purpose in life. That is the task that religion has set for itself. And then in American society, we find that divided between essentially two different ways of doing that. One, what I call a right hand of God approach, which builds those kinds of communities, but also imagines that the way for people to achieve much of what they want is to dominate and control and to dis or to not accept as equally valuable those who are not within that community. And on the other hand, a left hand of God vision that sees all human beings as equally valuable and equally deserving of love and caring and kindness and generosity. But that struggle between these two visions goes on within the religious world in America today and leaves many people angry at right hand of God religions, sometimes dismissing all religion or all orientation towards God or spirituality as fundamentally reactionary. So my basic view is, yes, religion has a very important role to play, but it matters what kind of religion and what kind of spiritual message. But a progressive spiritual vision could actually make a major contribution to healing some of the great contradictions that exist within American society today.
Mr. Maudlin.
Well, I think the first thing I'd say is that America is just characteristically, essentially, a religious nation. That's how we adjudicate issues. It's a primary language we use for understanding ourselves. Just for instance, just in the news, where we're a lot of people dealing with the tragedy at Virginia Tech, we aren't surprised to hear about memorial services and prayers as a way of dealing with those issues. That's just part of our what it means to be American. I mean, we have a whole history that's fraught with religious debate, religious issues, and without understanding those religious dynamics, I don't think you can fully understand our history or our politics or even our cultural events today. I think what's kind of interesting about today is I think religion, you know, every so many decades we go through some big debate about how do we describe it, what is the dynamic culturally, how we deal with religion. And I think it's starting to break out in new ways and new dynamics than it has been in the last 20, 30 years. So I think that's interesting, but it's that's not new to America, as part of Steve's book explains.
Mr. Prothero.
Well, I'm a historian, so I tend to think about these things a little bit in historical terms. And in terms of the relationship between religion and society, I think back to George Washington putting his hand on a Bible and swearing to uphold a godless constitution. So there's been a really interesting tension from the start between the secular nature of America by law and the religious nature of America by choice. One of the ironies of the First Amendment giving free choice to all American citizens to select their own religion is the fact that it produces one of the most religious countries in the world. Part of what I've been thinking about over the last few years, and as I discuss in my book, Religious Literacy, is that even though the United States is one of the most religious countries in the world, we know very little about religion, our own religion or those of other people. And so we're in a little bit of a fix here, with religion really running very rapidly into the public space and into political discussion, particularly since the 2004 elections, when the Democrats realized the Republicans were doing so well by invoking God so regularly. Democrats decided, of course, to do it too. So now we have both parties invoking Jesus, invoking the Bible, invoking God. And if we as citizens want to make sense of what these politicians are saying, we need to know something about religion, something about the Bible. If we want to understand what's going on in Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, we have to know something about Islam, and we actually know very little. So this, I think, is particularly prevalent since 2004, but it really goes back to Jimmy Carter and then Ronald Reagan. This way of speaking publicly, I would say it's more the Southern style rather than the New England style where I come from, the more confessional style of doing religion publicly. It's become more the national style over the last generation. And so my real concern isn't so much trying to chase religion back out of the public space, because I think that that's probably a losing battle in a country with so many believers, but rather to try to equip and empower more of us to engage in religiously inflected debates about stem cell research or abortion or the environment. Instead of sort of giving over that conversation to people who are the sort of the culture warriors, either on the secular left or the religious right, to empower us to participate fully by learning enough about Christianity and the Bible and Islam and other religions in order to take on politicians and really participate in these debates.
Here's a question from the audience, and it's, wouldn't it be better for everyone if politicians didn't refer so much to religion? Can't people feel transcendent and be secular rather than religious? And we'll start with Mr. Maudlin.
That's an interesting question. We're doing a book that's going to be coming out next January by Randall Balmer, teaches at Columbia University, on God in the White House. And one of the things the book tries to answer is, why in 1960 did you have John F. Kennedy having to give a speech in Houston assuring people that his religion will make no difference on his politics, that he is not captive to his religion or to the Pope? And he needed to do that in order to get elected, because that was the biggest among Protestant circles. People were worried that he would have to do whatever the Pope told him to do. And he assured everyone that religion played no role in his politics. Then you jump ahead to the year 2000, where you have President George W. Bush saying his favorite political philosopher is Jesus. And that did well. He did very well with that. So how did we get there? So whether or not they should is one question, but it's certainly true that people are feel compelled, politicians feel compelled now to lay out in this new dynamic what their faith commitments are. And in fact, I think those who have the most difficulty doing that are finding the most difficulty at the polls. I definitely saw that with Bob Dole, even with George Bush Sr., coming from a generation in which you were not public about your faith. Faith was a very private thing, and you did not show it off in front of people. Whereas you had someone like Bill Clinton, who was very comfortable talking in that more southern style, really knew the language of the church and did very well with that. I think it's part of the game of politics right now that you have to talk about those things, because it's part of the, I call it the barbecue test. I mean, you people who want to be comfortable with you at a barbecue and be able to talk to you, and that's kind of one of the languages about whether or not you're someone they can relate to. So I think politicians will continue to talk about it.
Mr. Prothero.
The question was, wouldn't it be better for everyone if politicians didn't talk so much about
religion?
My answer would be no, it's not better for everyone. The people it's not better for are people who have religious reasons for what they think politically, which is to say for the vast majority of the American people. So I hear this all the time, you know, that, gee, wouldn't it be better if, you know, we had a godless public space, you know, where if you had, say, a religious reason why you believed that Roe v. Wade was a good decision or you believed Roe v. Wade was a bad decision, you had to somehow translate it. You had to sort of get on, you know, Google, you know, translation service and translate it into secular language. I just find this kind of absurd. I think that people in a democracy should be able to give the actual reasons why they believe things. And then people who disagree with them should be able to give the actual reasons why they disagree. And the truth is that religion is not this sort of dangerous, combustible thing in America. I think quite the contrary. I mean, my students are not, you know, ready at each other's throats. You know, we were given a warning, you know, before here that, gee, this is kind of dangerous. You know, people might be at each other's throats. I'm not actually worried that that's going to happen either now or with my students or even in American politics. I think that we should allow people to give religious reasons for things. And if we disagree with these religious reasons, we disagree with them. We give it thumbs down. And if we agree, we can move forward.
Rabbi Lerner.
Yes, I agree with what you just said, Stephen. And I think that the underlying this is a fear of ideological debate. In fact, one of the things that you frequently hear is, let's talk about politics, but without any ideologies conflicting. Let's try to find some nice middle ground where nobody is really committed to a worldview. But that's a worldview. That's a worldview. The worldview that it's better to be in a world in which nobody is committed to a worldview is itself a worldview that is no better founded. It has no better foundation than any of the other worldviews. And very often people are looking for a world in which there is no real conflict between fundamental ideas. And I think it's much more important to allow those conflicts to arise and be discussed. And I don't think it's neutral to be in a public sphere in which there is no discussion of religious worldviews. Now, that's somewhat different than talking about religion meaning I have the only path to salvation, and you're not on my path. If you're not on my path, you're screwed. You're going to burn in hell. That conversation, I think, ought not to be in our politics. But if one is to say, well, my worldview leads me to believe that we should have no wars, and somebody else saying, no, well, my worldview leads me to believe that wars are totally appropriate as a mechanism or as a way of achieving peace in the long run. That kind of debate is totally appropriate and rooted in religions. There's no reason why it shouldn't be rooted in religions, although for others it won't be. You can be secular. The problem with secularism is that it doesn't recognize that it too is a worldview, that it too is a position. And so many secular people believe that they are being merely neutral. They are being merely neutral about these ultimate issues rather than actually having a substantive view. But that is a substantive view. It's a view, that often is based on a certain kind of scientism that says that that which is real and that which can be rational is that which can be validated through sense datum or measurement or something that is empirically available. That's a worldview. It's a totally reasonable worldview, but it has no better foundation than any other religion. It's another religion, but there's many people who hold that religion think that they're holding no religion. They actually are holding a religion. It's just a different one than the ones of the other religions around.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're discussing the role of religion in U.S. culture and society. Our panelists are Michael Lerner, rabbi and editor at Tikkun; Michael Maudlin, editorial director at Harper San Francisco; and Stephen Prothero, chair of the religion department at Boston University. And what we have here are a couple of questions pretty much touching on the same topic. Someone asks, is there a hope that religion could become a private spiritual practice rather than the attempts to influence government and laws? And the second one is more specific, and it's one that's pretty much, as they say on Law and Order, torn from the headlines. For example, Catholic Cardinal Roger Mahoney has publicly vilified Speaker Fabian Nunez for his support of the Compassionate Choice Act, which would allow doctors to prescribe drugs for people who wish to commit suicide. And the question that comes up right here is, does a religious leader or religious people in general, how far should they go in actually taking their views into the political sphere? And we're going to start with Mr. Prothero on that.
As far as they want. I think there's a hope underneath, especially the first question, which is really a repeat of the prior question, because in this case it's okay, we don't all have to be secular in order to have our citizen card that we can talk with in public, but we all have to agree to keep our religion private. This is the privatization of religion strategy. Religion is a private matter. There's no doubt about that. And there's a lot of other things in our lives that are private. But religion is also a public matter. In fact, the idea that religion is private is a really odd notion. It's a modern notion that arises in the midst of the Enlightenment, particularly Enlightenment critiques in the 18th century of religion. And so the idea that religious people need to sort of go over in the private corner in the privacy of their own home or the privacy of their own religious community and sort of shut up when they walk out into a sidewalk or a public forum or a political campaign, I think is silly. There are a lot of silly religious ideas, and they ought to be exposed as silly religious ideas, and they can't be exposed as such unless they're out in the public. So if somebody wants to say, you know, we shouldn't have assisted suicide laws and we shouldn't have it because the Pope says so, well, then I think that's a silly argument for Americans to take up. But if they can say something like, we shouldn't have assisted suicide laws because we as Jews and Christians and Muslims in the Western monotheisms value life because God is the creator of human life, maybe that's an argument that will influence politicians and should influence our public thought. Maybe it isn't. So I say I'm all for allowing people out in public to vet their religious ideas, and if they're good ones, they might win out, and if they're bad ones, they might be shot down.
Rabbi Lerner.
Yes, in my book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right, I lay out the ideas of a new national organization that we've created called the Network of Spiritual Progressives. And this organization, which, by the way, you can find on the web at www.spiritualprogressives.org, spiritualprogressives.org, is an attempt to bring together religious and spiritual people, including, by the way, spiritual people who don't believe in God or don't believe in any particular religion. So the word spiritual here is meant to encompass some of what I think the questioner was looking for. But to bring those together in order to put forward a different kind of politics in this country. And that politics is one that addresses the spiritual issues. Now, to rule that out of public debate is to rule out a whole kind of politics. For example, as I said, our central idea is that we need a new bottom line in this society. We need a way in which the rationality, productivity, and efficiency should no longer just be defined by how much money or power a corporation makes, an institution makes, a government policy leads to, our education or our medical system leads to, but instead should be defined also in terms of maximizing love and caring, kindness and generosity, ethical and ecological sensitivity, enhancing our capacity to respond to other human beings as embodiments of the sacred, enhancing our capacity to respond to the universe with awe and wonder. Now, these are policies that lead to specific political outcomes. For example, in our case, right now, we're advocating for a global Marshall Plan as part of the way of ending the war in Iraq, is to shift our focus to a way of healing the world instead of dominating the world. But this is a politics that should not be ruled out simply because it does derive from a religious and spiritual base. If you say to me, oh, well, I could believe in that and be secular also, fine. But there's no reason why I shouldn't come to it from the foundation of the religious and spiritual traditions that we bring together in this network, which include all of the branches of Christianity and Judaism and Islam and Hinduism and Buddhism and many others, Wicca, so forth. So there is no reason why that set of worldviews shouldn't be contending in the public sphere. And yes, you're not going to hear too many people talking about awe and wonder at the grandeur of creation, or treating other people as embodiments of the sacred in a politics that is purely secular. You don't hear that very much. Why should this position not be out there in the public sphere and contending against other worldviews?
Mr. Maudlin.
Well, I don't have too much to add. Those are both good responses, but I agree fully that you can't keep religion in the private sphere. I think almost every tradition would critique someone who wanted to limit their expression of faith to just the private sphere and say that's not a very holistic approach to your spirituality. We want to be connected and whole in how we express our spirituality, both when we're alone and in our private practices, but also in the world and how that shines forth. So I think all the traditions want to see this, that kind of public expression of their faith. The question is, how do you best do that? And that's, I think that was a good example that Rabbi Lerner expressed.
Now, we have a couple of questions here about religion in schools. And the question here is, do you think religion should be taught in public schools? In what way? And how should it be taught? And I believe that's a softball to toss up to Mr. Prothero there.
That's right. It is. Thank you. I appreciate that. It's a big, fat one. Yeah, in my religious literacy book, I argue, after noting how little Americans know about religion and how much American politicians talk about it, that we should do something about it by teaching about religion in the public schools. And the argument I make is we should have a world religions course, and we should also have a course about the Bible in literature and history, including in American history, so that students can understand the I Have a Dream speech of Martin Luther King, which is not understandable without some knowledge of, say, the story of the Exodus in the Hebrew Bible. A lot of people object to this on the grounds that it's unconstitutional, which is wrong, because if you read the rulings by the Supreme Court over the last 50 or 60 years on religion and public education, you'll see that the Supreme Court has very consistently said that you can't preach religion, you can't preach atheism in the public schools, but you can teach about religion and teach about atheism in the public schools. And not only can you, But you should. This is the most interesting thing that the Supreme Court said on this. They don't just say you can. They don't just say we give a constitutional stamp of approval. They say you can't understand Western music, you can't understand American literature, you can't understand the history of American political speechmaking without knowing something about the Bible, without knowing something about Christianity. You can't understand what's going on in the world in, for example, Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan without knowing something about Islam. Public school kids are falling behind private school kids on this because private schools generally teach about world religions. They teach to a great extent about the Bible. Not all of them, by the way, but you're much more likely if you are a private school kid to get this education, but it's pretty rare now in the public schools. I think it's necessary for our public civic life, and it's not a matter of trying to convert people. It's a matter of trying to educate people about Christianity and the world's religions.
Rabbi Lerner.
Agreeing with everything that you've said, I think I'd like to go a step further and argue that we need in the public sphere, in education, teaching of spiritual values that are, and not because I want to interfere with the neutrality of the public schools, but because I believe that they already do teach values, spiritual values, only ones that I'm strongly against. Not only my own experience, but the experience of my son and the experience of almost every generation is that going through schools, they are taught what is to be valued. And what is to be valued is to make it in this society. The whole Clinton transformation of schools, his attempt to say, okay, we need a new education program that will advance our well-being. And how did he articulate it? So that we would be the most competitive society in the world. We would not lose our prominence as number one. And so much of what education is about is teaching people how to compete with each other so that they can get to the highest rungs of power and money in the society. Those are a set of values that exist in the school and shape what is taught, how it's justified. Hey, this is going to get me the best job. This is going to get us the highest rank. Okay, all of that shapes our educational system dramatically. I want to see a different set of values shape our education system, namely values about how do we create the most loving and caring human beings possible, the ones who are most responsible when it comes to ecological considerations, the ones who are most committed to nonviolence and to working out disputes in a nonviolent way, the ones who are most talented in communicating to each other. So these are a different set of values. That's going to require bringing a struggle into the public sphere, but not because I am wanting to ruin this sweet, gentle, non-value-oriented school system, but because I already see it as filled with values, only the wrong values.
Mr. Maudlin.
I was just struck in Stephen's book, his observation that Europeans are a lot less religious in practice, but they do a lot better job about teaching religion, and the average European knows much more just religious history, religious facts than Americans, and how out of touch Americans are with even their own traditions, which is a powerful argument. I just want one response to Rabbi Lerner about the one thing I worry about in how to teach spiritual values in school. I just remember a story from a friend of mine who went to his local junior high for his daughter's presentation. It was a character education night, and they were going to show how they've been learning about character education. And this group of girls decided to do a dance showing respect. And at the end of it, they all, at the end of the song, they all turned their backs to the audience, and then all of a sudden bent over, and there on their backside was spelled R-E-S-P-E-C-T. And he thought, I think something got lost in transmission there.
If I could jump in for a second, because we're agreeing with each other too much, so I'm just going to disagree with Rabbi Lerner. I think that we can't teach spiritual values in the schools, at least we can't market I guess I would suggest a different marketing strategy to you, because it's unconstitutional. I mean, it's just plainly unconstitutional. So your argument is well taken that we already are teaching spiritual values. I think there's some truth to that. And if so, then we need to get the Constitution police on the case and stop. But the argument that we should teach spiritual values and the good ones instead of the bad ones is going to go, you know, precisely nowhere in American public life, nor, in fact, should it, because it's very clear in the way the Constitution has been interpreted, at least for the last 60 or 70 years, that's not permissible. I also want to distinguish between my proposal for education about religious studies in the public schools and character education, because sometimes it's confused. And my proposal, my book actually, Religious Literacy, has a critique of character education in the public schools. And I think that there has been an effort to enlist the study of religion, and particularly the study of the Bible, into a certain mode of character education that is a sort of stealth kind of Christianization or Judeo-Christianization of the school kids. And I don't think that's the way to go. I think that character education can happen, whether it's about respect or whether it's about multiculturalism or whatever it might be, can go forward as character education, which, because it is a secular word, seemingly secular word, might actually go, rather than, say, spiritual education. But I think that should be distinguished from school kids learning, say, the Ten Commandments, or learning what the four Gospels are, or reading the Gospel of Matthew and reading the book of Genesis and thinking about how those have contributed to American literature.
Couldn't you add that to the historical presentation so that that's not just reciting the facts or the stories about the religions and what they are, but, you know, how they're expressed? And so the values come out in that kind of historical context.
Well, I think you definitely can teach what the values are of particular religious traditions. But I think when you get to inculcating certain values, like a love of respect for creation, because God created the world, I mean, you can't do that in a public school. I mean, it will take about a half of a second for any Supreme Court justice to tell you that that's not permissible.
Rabbi Lerner?
Yes. Let's divide what you just said into two parts. The part of learning respect for or caring for the physical universe or nature or what I call creation. That part has never been ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. It's only when you add, because it was created by God, that you violate the separation clause. There's no separation. There's no reason in the world why spiritual values taught as spiritual values, but not taught as connected to my particular religion or to God, shouldn't be taught in the public sphere.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're discussing the role of religion in U.S. culture and society. Our panelists are Michael Lerner, rabbi and editor at Tikkun; Michael Maudlin, editorial director at Harper San Francisco; Stephen Prothero, chair of the religion department at Boston University. We've talked here about the effect that religion has on society, but to turn it around, as one questioner does, let's talk about the effect society has on religion. We have a question here that says, on page one of today's New York Times, Cardinal Egan is accused by some of neglecting spiritual values. Does religion generally diminish its sacred mission to obtain a place in the political arena in the country? And we'll start with Rabbi Lerner.
Yes, I think it does. I think that the kinds of religion we've seen in the actual practice in America has been overwhelmingly the religious right. And the way that the religious right has interacted with in the public sphere has been one which I think has given has discredited God in the eyes of a very large number of people, and made people feel like, if that's what God is about, I don't want any part of her. Well, they don't say it her, but anyway, but I certainly don't want any part of the kind of God that is presented to us in the public sphere, or the way that some of these religions operate in this public sphere, which is in the example given of Egan and also of the way that it operates very frequently in the public sphere, is coercive. But on the other hand, when I want to distinguish here, I don't want to then say, and therefore, there is no appropriate place for spiritual or religious communities in the public sphere. I think we have to remember that the tremendous accomplishments of the civil rights movement came out of the black churches who each demonstration began with a Christian service inside a church, and then from those churches went out into the streets for the demonstrations and brought with them Negro spirituals that have now become American spirituals that were deeply rooted in a religious tradition. I don't want to say that's bad, so I think we have to distinguish, and I think it's appropriate to distinguish between kinds of religion that are affirming of values like love and kindness and generosity and so forth, and religions that affirm domination, power, war, violence, and so forth. And you say, well, wait a second, how can you do that? Well, we do that in politics all the time. We distinguish between political views that we agree with and political views that we disagree with. And so similarly, in the sphere of religion and politics, we should be very free to be able to say, yeah, that kind of religious voice I'd like to hear, and that kind of religious voice I don't want to hear, and argue it on the substance, not think you can ban it on the form being anything that comes from religion or uses the word God is bad. Don't go for the formal. Go look at the substance and then argue the substance.
Mr. Maudlin.
I definitely think that the culture has a profound effect on us and our spirituality. I come from the evangelical world. Many years, the editor of Christianity Today magazine, which is a main kind of voice for and journal for evangelicals. One of the things I've always struck by is evangelicals is how they're so have adapted to kind of a consumer economy. And when you look at it and you see what they have built, which is an incredible network of distribution chain for their products, their books, their Bibles, they have separate bookstores, they have radio channels, they have TV networks, music business. It's just an amazing system they've built. And then you look over at the Catholic market, which is huge, 75 million Americans, and probably the largest cohesive religious body in the United States. And you have very small distribution. You have very small stores, have a very kind of folksy network of music, there's now one radio station, TV station, Mother Angelica, very conservative. But to me, one of the explanations for that is, one has not said we're going to take on this kind of American values of consumer culture, whereas one community says, oh, we're very comfortable with that language, and I think has been profoundly shaped by it. And I think there's deep ambivalence in the evangelical world, I know, about that. So I think that's the heart of a lot of the books we're publishing today is kind of sorting out how are we influenced by the culture? How does it shape us?
Mr. Prothero.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to the early debates about separation of church and state. Before we even had the First Amendment, and how one of the main impulses was to protect not government from the interference of religion, but was to protect religion from the interference of politics. And one of the most interesting data points for me on this question is the rise of the so-called religious nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, not the N-U-N-S with the habits, but the N-O-N-E-S when asked, what religious affiliation are you? They say none. I have no religious affiliation. Doesn't mean they don't believe in God or even that they're not religious. It just means that they don't affiliate themselves, self-identify as Christian or Jewish or something. And that figure has gone up pretty dramatically over the last 10 years or so. By some accounts, it's doubled. And one of the most intriguing arguments that's been made to try to explain this rise is that increasingly people understand religion to be conservative politically. And so insofar as people don't want to say when asked on a survey, are you conservative politically? If so, answer Christian. They say none. They say I have no religious affiliation. This hasn't really been discussed very much, but it seems to me really, really important. And it seems to me that one of the sources of America's vibrant religiosity, which distinguishes it from Europe, is the fact that religion and politics have historically been held to some extent in separate arenas. And the collapse of those separate arenas over the last generation is really a new sort of thing in American life. Not that, I mean, I opened by talking about George Washington with his Bible and the Godless Constitution, so this is not a totally new thing. But it seems to me new in sort of the amount and the force. And so it's an intriguing question. To what extent is American religious vibrancy going to be diminished by the close association of, in this case, Christianity with a particular form of politics?
One of the things that you just touched on is something that a number of our people in the audience are interested in. They're asking a couple of questions. So, for example, one is, why does so much of today's public religion seem fundamentalist or extreme? And looking at the historical part, why is it that the fervent religion was on the liberal side in the 60s, but on the conservative side now? What's changed? And we'll start with Rabbi Lerner on that.
Okay. Well, for one thing, what has changed has been the conviction in the part of the liberal and progressive world, a vision, a shared vision that they could mobilize around. And what happened at the end of the 60s and the early 70s was a kind of vision of, well, what we need to do is to take our pre-existing policy matters and take them through the existing institutions, win legal battles, win battles inside those institutions. And there was a, let's say, a decrease in idealism and an increase in pragmatism. But pragmatism meant working within the framework of, well, what's real, what's possible in this world. And that, I think, is combined with a larger issue that has always been there in the left, which is that the left is religiophobic. It doesn't have, in its core, a set of ideas that give adequate place to religion and spirituality. And so even those of us who were religious in the 60s found it very hard to push in. And it was only because Martin Luther King, as an African-American, could do that, and we were already against discrimination against African-Americans. So then we in the left had this view that you're not supposed to tell third world or oppressed people what us white people think is right. So then you had to create a space for that. But it was a tolerance without an acceptance of religiosity. So in the study that I did about the psychodynamics of American society that's in this book, The Left Hand of God, many of the people that I spoke to were people who left the left in part because they found it so hostile or so unaccepting, because there was such a deep fundamentalist secularism in the left, a fundamentalist secularism that says essentially this message to people. If you're religious or spiritual, we want you in the liberal or progressive world because we need your vote and so forth, and we need your energy. But we hope that eventually you will come to a higher level of psychological or intellectual development, because basically, if you believe in God or if you believe in those spiritual paths, you're probably on a lower level of psychological development or probably a lower level of intellectual development. We may not knock you over the head with that because we need you in our movement, but basically our culture is saying that to you over and over and over again, that we don't think you're really like us and we need you to come up, and we hope that through rubbing shoulders with us in progressive movements, you'll come to this higher secular perspective and realize that there is no rational basis for what you believe in and so forth. Well, that has pushed away an awful lot of people. But that has combined with the pragmatism to create a left that doesn't have a worldview, that doesn't have a coherent vision. And that's one of the things that the Network of Spiritual Progressives is now trying to develop as an alternative to what is liberal politics, is a worldview that could express some of the deepest values that many people who are liberal and progressive are actually hold personally, but it's never articulated in progressive politics. So all of that contributes to why you don't feel today, or you don't hear today, the self-confidence from a spiritual or religious vision on the left that you have with a religious and spiritual vision on the right.
Mr. Maudlin.
Yeah, I would add to that, too, that a lot of people talk about media bias. I think there is a media bias about religion, but the bias isn't what people usually mean by it. News people really love for what makes good TV or good radio. And we have found often when we're trying to promote our authors that they're much more likely to book extreme voices rather than the informed voices. So why do you hear more from fundamentalists? Well, they're more likely to say something outrageous. So you're more likely to hear from Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, Tin LaHaye on the far right, just because, you know, they'll say something that will get ratings up, will spike interest, be controversial, and pick up news. We see that over and over again when we have the better informed, more expert person on a topic will just be dismissed. So I think that skews religion coverage in a major way.
Mr. Prothero?
Yeah, I want to agree with Mickey on that, and the part of the question that I really liked was, you know, why does public religion seem so extreme? And I think the key word there is seem, and the answer is, as has been said, is the media. The culture wars, I believe, when it comes to religion, is really an artifact of media culture. If you wander around the United States, and San Francisco, admittedly, is kind of an odd place, as is Boston in that regard. I mean, we are not in middle America here. But if you wander randomly around San Francisco or even wander randomly toward, you know, Kansas and into Arkansas and up, you know, over to upstate New York, and you just talk to people about religion, you won't find people talking like the way the crazy secular left talks and the way the crazy religious right talks. They just don't do it. The places people do that is on TV. Most of us are in the middle. Most of us are in the sort of sane religious middle where we're a little bit confused, we're a little bit, you know, committed, we're trying to figure out how religion and science might work together. We don't have a sense that, you know, one is having this huge pitched battle. You know, it's the culture warriors who are in this sort of medieval, you know, early modern mindset that there's this, you know, horrible, you know, conflict going on. And so the extremity in terms of religion is about what it seems to be, not what it is. And most Americans, when it comes to religion, are in that sort of sane space. And that's part of why I'm hopeful that we can get more study about religion in the public schools, as I argue for in my religious literacy book, because I think that most people are not, you know, battling about this. They're not interested in a battle. They're interested in solutions.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're discussing the role of religion in U.S. culture and society. Our panelists are Michael Lerner, rabbi and editor at Tikkun, Michael Maudlin, editorial director at Harper San Francisco, and Stephen Prothero, chair of the religion department at Boston University. We've talked a little bit about the spiritual values that religion brings to the country. A question from a couple of the people in the audience is, do you think that atheism and agnosticism lack spiritual values? And moving in the same direction, why can't there be spiritual values without religion? And let's start with Mr. Maudlin.
Well, I mean, that's a difficult question. Of course, people can be very spiritual and deeply moral and be atheists. How does that actually function? I mean, I was surprised at the popularity of Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris's books recently, because one of the things that really struck me is that I thought they were both surprisingly poorly argued. I think I could have made better arguments for atheism than they did. They were angry. They were angry at religion. They just thought it was dumb. And I don't think that's a profound critique. But, you know, the religious people, we all get our values from somewhere, some vision of how the world should be, and many people act on those things. So I've known there's a lot of people who've made profound contributions to this country and pushing us in better directions who did not have a spiritual basis for doing that. So I don't think the two necessarily go together, but they often do. People do have, spiritual visions do have political consequences, and that's how a lot of people, like most Americans, that's how they express them, is politically, is something stemming from some spiritual vision they've had.
Mr. Prothero?
Yeah, I think it's really, for me, the only way to answer that is to try to get into what the difference is between religion and spirituality. I mean, my students at Boston University are very prone to say, as many young people are, and many even baby boomers are, I'm spiritual but not religious. And I think what they mean by that is that they don't like certain forms of organized religion, certain forms of institutional religion. They may be meaning they didn't like their CCD classes when they were young Catholics. They may be meaning that they think their minister is kind of goofy the way he dresses or she speaks. So I think to a great extent the move toward talking about spirituality instead of talking about religion has to do with a kind of very typically American and I would say frankly Protestant skepticism about institutional hierarchical religion. But as a religious studies person, I don't accept the sharp distinction. I think that spirituality is a part of religion. It always has been. And that what we're seeing in contemporary America is an interest in extracting certain spiritual practices, like, say, Buddhist meditation strategies, out of the history of Buddhism, out of Buddhist philosophy, or the classic case is yoga, you know, extracting the spirituality, the spiritual practice of yoga out of a thousands-year-old religious tradition of Hinduism. So, yes, you can have spiritual values without religion, but I would say that spirituality really, to be understood, at least from a historical perspective, needs to be understood in light of the religious traditions that have sustained it over the years.
Rabbi Lerner.
Yes, I have a synagogue here. I'm the rabbi of a synagogue in San Francisco called Beit Tikkun, and many of the people who come to my synagogue, to Beit Tikkun, are people who identify themselves as spiritual but not religious. They, when I ask them about that, they tell me about their reasons for being very angry at God or very angry at religions. And I must say that most of their reasons are very good. And if God or religion were only what most people have experienced, I'd be an atheist. In other words, I wouldn't believe in the God that many people have been exposed to, and I certainly wouldn't want to be identified with religious communities that have been extremely hurtful. And I say that also about my own religion, not just about other religions, because many of the people who come to my synagogue are people who identify with the Israeli peace movement and against the occupation of the West Bank, and that is being done in part in the name of religion. And I luckily in our synagogue, because I support the position of the peace movement, people can come there. But for an awful lot of other people, they're estranged from the Jewish religious world entirely because it seems to be a cheerleading block for Israeli policy. So I don't blame people for a whole variety of reasons being angry at religion and saying, I don't want to have any part of it. And I certainly would be the first to say that there is no reason in the world why one cannot be totally ethically sensitive and at least as ethically centered as anybody in the religious world without believing in God. And there's no reason in the world why people can't be spiritual without being religious. But having said that, I want to reemphasize the points that were made by the last two speakers, that there is something that is nurturing to that consciousness in the religious tradition that isn't so nurturing in the traditions of global capitalism, and the worldview that says that that which is real is that which can produce money and power. And that is the dominant religion that we live in. Only because it's so dominant, most people don't think of it as religion. They think of it as just as common sense. But that's what it is to be in a religion. To be in a religion really is to take its fundamental assumptions as self-evident. And so we live in a society in which the dominant values of this society constitute a religious system with all the same characteristics, including its own rituals, its own ways of behaving, its own set of who's in and who's out. And that religious system is so pervasive that nobody gets that it's a religious system. I believe that we need other religious or spiritual systems to counter that dominant system. And I want to, so that's why I'm very supportive of people, but I don't believe there's any one right religious path. There are many, many religious paths, any one right spiritual path. There are many such paths. They all may contribute to a different consciousness that's desperately needed in the world today, a consciousness of the unity of all humanity, of the need to protect the earth, of the need for peace, of social justice, of nonviolence, those kinds of values that I don't see any other institutions even claiming as their central raison d'etre.
It seems that whereas most people might not be, as you said, looking for a fight when it comes to religion, certainly that might not apply to lawyers. And we have a couple of questions here, essentially asking, how should we deal with the day-to-day stuff that keeps appearing? For example, one person asks, how can Christians state that this is a Christian country when that offends the many members of non-Christians' religions? And another one asked a comment about crosses on public lands and nativity scenes in civic areas and menorahs in Union Square and all that sort of thing, the Easter Bunny and holiday celebrations and whatever. How does a secular society with a religious overtone deal with these sort of questions? And I'm going to start with Mr. Prothero.
And I have 1 minute to resolve that.
No, you have. Go ahead. You got a couple of minutes.
Good. That should be simple. Well, if you want to do a civic display of religion, you have to follow the three reindeer rule. We all know that, right? I mean, the three reindeer rule is the rule of the Supreme Court, which says that if you put out a nativity scene with Jesus and Mary and Joseph and the wise men, that if you have to have three reindeer and maybe some, you know, happy Christmas signs and a Christmas tree and that sort of thing, and then it's okay. In other words, you have to dilute down the religion with some secularity. That's the strategy. It's very funny, actually, how this reindeer rule works, because that really is what the Supreme Court does. It looks to see if there are sufficient numbers of reindeer. And if you only have one, that probably isn't enough. But if you have three and some candy canes, that will probably work. This seems kind of funny, but, you know, to me, in some ways, this is sort of the magic of the American legal system. I mean, it's in the details, you know, the old line that God is in the details. Well, the constitutionality also sometimes is in the details. And the question is, does a display give the impression that the city is supporting Christianity or supporting Judaism or critiquing religion or saying this is a Hindu town, you know? If it does that, then it's unconstitutional. You know, the broader question of Christian country, you know, Judeo-Christian country, Abrahamic country, multi-religious country. This is a really interesting question to me, the history of how we have shifted as a culture to imagining our religious character. And I think right now we're in the midst of debating whether we're an Abrahamic country or a multi-religious country. And the sort of slogan I put on this is that we are a secular country by law, but we are have become a Christian society by choice. And the question is, to what extent are Christians going to be allowed to sort of put the veneer and the sensibility and the feeling and the smells and the images of Christianity out in the public space? And to what extent do they need to defer to the multi-religious realities that we see around us here in San Francisco and elsewhere? And because I only have 2 minutes, I'm not gonna answer that. I'm just gonna pose it.
Rabbi Lerner.
I'm very glad that we have a separation clause, and I'm very glad that the Supreme Court is doing what it has done to require that governments not weigh in on the side of any particular religion. Having said that, I understand in the Jewish world why it's a very significant issue, because for 2,000 years, Christians were dragging us off in various ways, trying to coerce us and beat up on us and kill us, murder us, rape us, etc. Okay, so we don't want to be in a society where that's going to happen again, and I understand the sensitivities there. But I think it's the wrong battle. I think even though I support it, I don't think that's where the key battle is. The key battle is not what's destroying Christmas, is not that there is too much, there are too many religious symbols in the public sphere, or not enough religious symbols in the public sphere. What's destroying Christmas and much else of religion is the dominance of the other religion that I'm trying to tell you about. It's the religion that says that what Christmas is about is buy, 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 buy. Consume as much as possible. Your value is in how much you can give or in how much you can receive. That's what really counts. That's the central value. Don't you? And what I'm saying is, get it. That's the religion. That's the dominant religion. It's not Christianity or Judaism or whatever. It's this religion of corporate capitalism. That's the dominant religion, and the consumption, the notion that your value is and how much you make and how much you spend. And that's what has to be challenged in the public sphere, and not so much a Christmas tree or a reindeer.
Mr. Maudlin.
I think part of the power of this issue comes from how religion functions and how the story functions. Part of what we do is tell our own story. What story are we a part of? And for many people, being a part of a Christian nation is kind of fundamental to their self-understanding. If you're and it might seem still very true, for instance, the suburbs of Dayton, Ohio, where my parents live, that, you know, most all of us are Christian, and that's where our values are, that's who we are. And they get nervous when they're, you know, they think about what are the alternatives to understanding it that way. And I think that's why there's still these kind of debates. And I think this is one of those issues in which I think San Francisco itself is a leader and on the cutting edge of for the rest of the nation. If we don't define ourselves more narrowly, it used to be at the very beginning we were a Protestant nation and the bad guys were the Catholics, and then it was a Christian nation that included the Catholics, and then it was the Judeo-Christian nation, non-theists. And now it's a little bit more amorphous, and we're still in the midst of that debate. Is what does it mean to value religion, but not come from one specific privileged paradigm, even as simple as theism? That's part of the cultural debate we're having, and I think that's where we're going into. We're just starting to figure out what does it mean to be so globally minded. And for most of history, we haven't been aware of other religions and other faiths and just all the different traditions out there. We're just starting to bring that into our consciousness and figure out what does it mean in our day-to-day understanding that God has so many names and so many people go to God in so many different ways. For most of history, people haven't known about this as much as we do. And I think, I think San Francisco is at a cutting edge of how we adjudicate those things and make them meaningful so that we can have a culture that accepts and values religion and spirituality, but in a way that includes everybody.
We've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question, and I'm going to have to ask you to try and keep your comments relatively brief. I'm not going to give you a question that lends towards that, but here it is anyway. With so much profession of religion in America, why is day-to-day life in America so ruthlessly competitive and so often cruel to individuals? In other words, why do people talk one thing and seem to do another? And we'll start with Rabbi Lerner.
As I said, because we have a dominant religion that is different from the religions that everyone professes. It's a religion of selfishness and materialism, of looking out for number one. And the other religions, all of our religions, whatever they are, don't do a good job of challenging that dominant religion. So if you want to see a change in daily life, We need to challenge the bottom line of American society with a new set of values and a new vision. I think that's there in the left hand of God, but I think that there are people in every religious and spiritual tradition, but also many secular and people who have nothing to do with religion or spirituality who want to challenge that bottom line. They need to get together. They need to work together to challenge that bottom line of selfishness.
Mr. Maudlin.
I agree. I think we're very good at bifurcating our lives and kind of putting our religion in one box and our day-to-day lives and how we structure our lives in another, and very content to let them be separate. But I think Rabbi Lerner's right. I think the best direction for religion is to help see new ways in which it can inform the rest of our lives, what we do in our work, what we do in our investments, what we do in our private time.
Mr. Prothero.
I guess I might say that one reason why, even though we're so religious, we're still do bad things is because religion often causes us to do bad things. I mean, I think there's the notion that religion is this good thing and then secularity is the bad thing, or capitalism is the bad thing and religion is the good thing. I mean, you know, one argument that I make in my book is religion is the most powerful force for evil in the history of the world, and I also think it's the most powerful force for good in the history of the world, and that is to say that religion is the most powerful force in the history of the world, and that powerful forces like that can be used in good ways, and they can be used in bad ways. So I don't know that religion is necessarily the solution to whatever problems that we have. I think that it's a powerful force that can be used in one direction or another, and ideally we would be trying to be the sorts of people that would be using religion or atheism or spirituality or whatever it is in the good direction rather than in the bad direction.
Thank you all. And I'd like to thank all our panelists, Michael Lerner, rabbi and editor at Tikkun, Michael Maudlin, editorial director at Harper San Francisco, Stephen Prothero, chair of the religion department at Boston University. We also would like to thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm John Wildermuth. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
I love it. I love the tradition of the game.